Okay, so I have this. I have these friends who have a 1.5-year-old daughter, and she's learning to speak now. And so, but she only speaks in one words. And I don't know if this is. I haven't been around children much, so I don't know how common this is. But every word then kind of ends on an inflection, as if she's asking a question. So it's like, cat? And for some reason, she likes to point out cans. So she goes, can? And so everything becomes a question. And so I don't know what's going on in her mind, but maybe that's what it is. She's kind of completely curious and excited about what is this stuff out there and in here in the world. And so she's asking, is that, you know, everything becomes a question. And I thought that was a nice maybe preface to the talk that I wanted to give today, which is about questioning, the art of questioning, the role of questioning in our spiritual life. And maybe then it's also appropriate to mention that in giving this talk and thinking about it, it represents for me questions I have about spiritual life, but also I'm very curious about the role of questioning itself. So I have questions about questioning. So this talk is more of one big question mark than it is anything else. Some things are said simpler. And I'm also, you know, I'm fond of words, and one of the nice things is that the word question and the word quest come from the same Latin root, same Latin word, querere, which means to seek. And we talk about a spiritual quest, and I think that there is a relationship between a spiritual quest and questioning. And I think questioning is one of the things that helps keep a spiritual life from becoming complacent or stagnant. It's our deep questioning which keeps it helps us kind of move beyond hearing spiritual knowledge or knowledge about the world, about ourselves, and keeping it only a second-hand knowledge. You read a book about Buddhism or practice, and it's our deep questioning or questing that wants to make it into first-hand knowledge, personal knowledge, something we know for ourselves. Questioning perhaps is closely related to the factor of enlightenment called investigation, which is the factor of enlightenment which is energizing, brings energy to the practice. And I think that's one of the functions of questioning. It brings energy, enthusiasm, vitality into our life and can bring it into our life. So there's a story. This story concerns a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. Once a great order, as a result of waves of anti-monastic persecution in the 17th and 18th centuries and the rise of secularism in the 19th, all its branch houses were lost, and it had become decimated to the extent that there were only 5 monks left in the decaying mother house, the abbot and 4 others, all over 70 years in age. Clearly, it was a dying order. In the deep woods surrounding the monastery, there was a little hut that a rabbi from a nearby town occasionally used for a hermitage. Through their many years of prayer and contemplation, the old monks had become a bit psychic, so they could always sense when the rabbi was in his hermitage. "The rabbi is in the woods, the rabbi is in the woods again," they would whisper to each other. As he agonized over the imminent death of his order, it occurred to the abbot at one such time to visit the hermitage and ask the rabbi if by some possible chance he could offer any advice that might save the monastery. The rabbi welcomed the abbot at his hut, but when the abbot explained the purpose of his visit, the rabbi could only commiserate with him. "I know how it is," he exclaimed. "The spirit has gone out of the people. It is the same in my town. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old abbot and the old rabbi wept together. Then they read parts of the Torah and quietly spoke of deep things. The time came when the abbot had to leave. They embraced each other. "It has been a wonderful thing that we should meet after all these years," the abbot said, "but I have still failed in my purpose for coming here. Is there nothing you can tell me, no piece of advice you can give me, that would help me save my dying order?" "No, I am sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice to give. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." When the abbot returned to the monastery, his fellow monks gathered around him to ask, "Well, what did the rabbi say?" "He couldn't help," the abbot answered. "He just wept and read the wept and read the Torah together. The only thing he did say, just as I was leaving, it was something cryptic, was the Messiah is one of us. I don't know what he meant." In the days and weeks and months that followed, the old monks pondered this and wondered whether there was any possible significance to the rabbi's words. The Messiah is one of us? Could he possibly have meant one of us monks here at the monastery? If that's the case, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot? Yes, if he meant anyone, he probably meant Father Abbot. He has been our leader for more than a generation. On the other hand, he might have meant Brother Thomas. Certainly Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly could not have meant Brother Elred. Elred gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he is a thorn in the people's sides, when you look back on it, Elred is virtually always right. Often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Elred. But surely not Brother Philip. Philip is so passive, a real nobody. But then, almost mysteriously, he has a gift of somehow always being there when you need him. He just magically appears by your side. Maybe Philip is the Messiah. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. He couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet supposing he did, suppose I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I don't know if the inflection was right. I couldn't be that much, could I? As they contemplated in this manner, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the off chance that one among them might be the Messiah. And on the off chance that each monk himself might be the Messiah, they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Because the forest in which it was situated was beautiful, it so happened that people still occasionally came to visit the monastery to picnic on its tiny lawn, to wander along some of its paths, even now and then to go into the dilapidated chapel to meditate. As they did so, without even being conscious of it, they sensed this aura of extraordinary respect that now began to surround the five old monks and seemed to radiate out from them and permeate the atmosphere of the place. There was something strangely attractive, even compelling about it. Hardly knowing why, they began to come back to the monastery more frequently to picnic, to play, to pray. They began to bring their friends to show them this special place. And their friends brought their friends. Then it happened that some of the younger men who came to visit the monastery started to talk more and more with the old monks. After a while, one asked if he could join them, then another and another. So within a few years, the monastery had once again become a thriving order, and thanks to the rabbi's gifts, a vibrant center of light and spirituality in the realm. So I like the story partly because it goes from a story of stagnation, in a sense, to vitality. From stagnation, the rabbi kind of makes a statement that raises questions in all these monks' minds. Who is the Messiah? Is it the others? Is it me? Well, maybe I better allow for the possibility that it's one of us. So the questioning is the allowing for possibility, for something unknown that's not really even sure. And what I like so much about this story is that the questioning, the opening to the possibility is what makes possible the coming of at least the renewed spirituality of the center. If they hadn't had the questioning or the opening to that strange possibility that one of them was the Messiah, the stagnation would have continued, or they would have just, the order would have died out. So I think part of the function of questioning is that it opens up the doors of possibility. And in the doors of possibility, things enter in that might otherwise have stayed out. So the function of questioning is not necessarily so much to maybe provide answers. The function of questioning is to keep us open to the infinite number of possibilities that will come down our way as the future arrives into the present. I believe myself that questioning is indispensable to the spiritual life, because it is this opening up and keeping open of the possibilities which is what spirituality is, at least the Buddhist spirituality. There's a saying, I don't know who said it, but trust those who seek the truth, but not those who found it. And there's often a tension in life between desire for order, for security, for certainty, for identity, whether it's individual identity or group identity. There's a tension between that and the drive to go from a closed, fixed system to open ones, to go beyond the limitations of a fixed order or a fixed identity or a fixed system of whatever, belief or social order or whatever. That somehow we always sense what's on the outside of anything fixed. And that sense of something outside becomes at least awakens our curiosity, because as long as things are fixed, there's limited amount of possibility. But if we can open to the unknown beyond the fixed order, fixed security, fixed identity, we open up to wider possibilities. And I believe there's a drive in all of us to find that, to go there. You know, perhaps it can be said that each generation does it. Each new generation, when they're teens and their 20s, that's part of the tension with the older generations. It's inherent in the cycles of generations. As the newer generations begin sensing the wider possibilities that the older generation has kind of limited itself to. And the desire for security and order is often expressed in our social institutions, in our government, in our religious institutions, and even in the institutions of marriage. And just to talk about religion, since we're kind of connected to that kind of world. But religion as a social institution, my impression is reading history of religion is that it tends to create self-contained systems. It tends to belong often, once a religion kind of gets established in society, it tends to support a self-contained fixed order or self-contained system of theology or belief that is not supposed to have any loopholes or any, it's not supposed to have any gaps or any openness to the unknown. And you know, the extreme version of this, I suppose, would be fundamentalism. And there are fundamentalists, certainly, I mean, I learned the word around Christians, but there are fundamentalist Buddhists, and there's probably fundamentalists of every possible religion. And I believe, you know, I could be wrong, but it seems to be fundamentalists are people who have a limited fixed system, religious system, belief system, doctrinal system, in which everything is supposed to fit, and it's not open to the wider unknown of possibilities beyond that system. And in this sense, religious systems are perhaps less the manifestation of the individual's quest for higher or deeper or wider spiritual sensibilities, as it is a limitation on that development or that quest. Such religions perhaps don't tell us, you know, go seek the truth, but rather it might say, seek no further. You found it. And then I was thinking, perhaps language itself some of the ways in which we use language have this quality of fixing things, so that things begin needing to kind of fit into this limitations that words sometimes put on our reality or experience. And we can see it, language or even our modes of thinking, but perhaps we can see it in our excessive use of nouns, because nouns are, you know, noun is a thing, a more or less kind of a stable thing, rather than an action, rather than a process. In the Buddhist analysis of reality, is most things are processes. And if we call things by nouns, what we're doing is referring to them as an abstraction, not as they actually are. So if someone is called, says, you know, I'm a father, because, well, that's fair enough. I mean, someone can be a father who has a child. But are they, in some sense, they're always a father if once they've had a child. But it's perhaps more realistic to refer to them as someone who's fathering. And sometimes we're fathering, and sometimes we're cooking, and sometimes we're working, and there's different things we do. But how necessary it is to limit ourselves to the role of a father, or a role, you know, we say, we know, a lot of us do our cooking, but how many of us call ourselves cooks? You know, it's a famous story that I've told often in my own life. I used to do art, I guess. What is it? Arting? I don't know what it's called. Painting. Painting. So I was painting, and I enjoyed myself quite a bit. And then I decided to make myself into an abstraction, a noun, and I was an artist. And once I had that abstraction in mind, I had to live by that abstraction. So what is the noun of an artist? What is an artist supposed to do in order to be an artist? They have to art. And suddenly I was arting because of the identity and not because of this inner movement within me. And then I stopped doing it. I lost my interest, actually. And I think too often we turn ourselves and we turn other people and we turn the environment into abstractions. How many times, you can pay attention to how many times in a day you think or talk about someone as an abstraction. That jerk. You know, but all of us know what it's like to be on the receiving end of that. You know, if someone sees us as a role, as a wife or as a husband only, or who we're connected to, or a certain role, or a certain history that we have. The history ties us down and limits us in people's eyes. You know, oh, you treated me in, you know, you in bad way in the past, therefore I'm not going to allow for the possibility that you'll ever treat me nice again. That's holding them to, in a fixed way, to some past idea and abstraction, rather than being open to the theoretical possibility that they're different and new each time you meet them. So if we see life as an open process, an open creative process, rather than anything that can be bound by fixed systems, fixed institutions, fixed names, identities. The spiritual quest is a continuous questioning of life itself. So that the questioning is what takes us beyond the inherent limitations that our culture, our society, and our language, and our own mind seems to put on our reality. So if we can make that, if we begin questioning, what is this? What is this Sangha that I'm involved in here? What is this belief that I'm, what is this meditation practice that I'm doing? Who am I? What is the society I'm involved in? What is this work that I'm doing? Who is this person that I'm meeting right now? To have that question, what or who, is actually beautiful questions, because if we use it to open to wider possibilities than what, you know, we have abstracted beforehand, our preconceived ideas. It means to seek or to quest after that which we have no experience. There's a beautiful thing in Zen practice where it's said that when you kind of succeed your teacher in Zen, or you've received Dharma transmission from your teacher, so you can be a teacher, that in order for you to kind of succeed your teacher, you have to surpass your teacher. And I think that's a great idea. You have to surpass. You have to surpass him by half a time more. It isn't just like barely over the edge, but you have to a big step beyond him or her. And I think that's inherent in spirituality, because we always have to go beyond whatever fixed things we've inherited from the past. So in thinking about questioning, I think one of the issues to ask is, where do the questions come from? And I think maybe that's an important question. The two other important questions that is the question of how to ask a question, and the third is what you can ask, what kind of questions you can hold. But where do the questions come from? What is the motivation behind the question? To understand, to look carefully at the motivation, the intention that that question wants to fulfill. Because often, for example, our questioning can represent a yearning or a longing. And I think spiritual questing is not yearning or longing. It's not trying to get something out there. It's not trying to attain something. It's not trying to compensate for feelings of inadequacy, feelings of insecurity, feelings of emptiness, or, you know, it's not... I don't think spiritual questing is that. I think spiritual questioning is simply an open-heartedness, kind of, what is this? Without really even needing to know the answer, without needing anything to come. There's a beautiful poem in Zen that I've quoted many times, and one line says, it, and it is reality, it responds to the inquiring impulse. Simply to inquire, simply to hold a question, something about reality responds. Perhaps like the story of the monks. They opened to the possibility that there was a Messiah amongst them, and something responded in their situation. So to understand what motivates our questions is a very important part of our practice. Our motivation is always a subject of our mindfulness practice. There's a difference between expectation and interest, between expectation and needing to know something, or expecting an answer, or needing to have an answer, and a joyful curiosity. Someone once said that joy is curious. It's a nature of joy to be curious. It's a nature of joy to be interested, to have interest. Is that true? I suspect it's true. That when you see someone, especially if you see a child, if you see someone who's full of joy, there's a kind of interest, curiosity in being in the world and what's happening in front of them, a kind of exuberance, enthusiasm. So where does the asking come from? Does it come from our surface mind, our surface concerns, or does it come from a deep within us, in the deep stillness of our heart, the stillness of our mind, at the deeper layers of our spirituality? Or is it simply, you know, you heard the latest commercial on television, and so you say, well, which cellular phone should it be? So that's related to the second question, which is how to ask questions. And it's to ask, one of the ways of spiritual questing is to ask deep down the roots of our being. And how do we do that? And I think that meditation is a powerful way to do that. To sit quietly and allow the body and the mind to settle so the surface chatter, the surface concerns that kind of so often run our lives has a chance to settle down. And then to listen carefully. What wells up from deep inside? What kind of questions do you have about your life? Naturally, if you listen very deeply, with a deep, deep listening. One of the ways is to be in touch with our body. Our body is like, repeatedly say, I think, is not an abstraction. So one way to stop living in abstractions of the mind is to come through and out of the body into our life, to sense and feel our body, the direct tangible experience of our bodies. What kind of questions does the body have? And the body itself can be a question, and it can be expressed in words and mind, but the body itself, I think, if the body itself is alive, I think it itself becomes kind of a question. How does it meet the next situation? You come into a room you've never been in. The body questions, what is this? How to be in this room? There's the questioning, how to ask in the context, in particular context. It can be very powerful to place yourself in certain contexts, then ask yourself some deep questions. Place yourself in the context of death. And there's many ways of doing that, but you can do it as an imaginary exercise. Imagine you're going to die this evening before you get home, or tomorrow morning, soon. What is most important for you? in that context. The question, what is most important, I think, is one of the more primary questions we can ask ourselves. To get quiet, to be still, to face our death, to face the other mysteries of life. And in the midst of that, to ask, what is most important for us? How to ask? We can ask without expecting an answer. The generic vipassana question is, what is this? What is this? You can say that all the time. What is this? What is this? And you do that and you'd be completely successful in a mindfulness practice. When I meet with people, especially one-on-one for interviews, for example on retreats, I see sometimes a dramatic shift in the kind of questions people will ask, depending on how deeply in touch they are in their body, in their direct physical experience of what's happening moment to moment. And it's often, it helps to be on retreat because the surface mind chatter kind of settles and quiets down. And a deeper questioning, very sincere and very focused, can arise out of people in that context. And I see people who haven't done that work, and even the fifth day of the retreat they might come, and they haven't really settled on themselves. They haven't really turned inward to ask deep questions of themselves. And they come to interview and they want to ask about, on the fifth day of the retreat, you know, it's like they want to know what kind of books I can recommend for they could read. And that's often a good question, but the fifth day of the retreat, when there's 5 days left, they're thinking about, you know, what kind of books they can read. I think maybe, you know, sometimes I suspect that they're afraid of asking the deep questions or looking deeply, and so they stay in the surface concerns. Or maybe they're afraid of me, and so it's a nice way of kind of getting a question during an interview, and that's safe. I don't know. Do I seem like a scary person? Uh-oh. So mindfulness is the function of mindfulness in part is to help us get in touch with what is really most essential for us, and then to live a life which is not in conflict with that. To be in touch with what's essential and not live without being in conflict with that. So what is most important for us? So we get into the third question, what to ask. What is most important? So someone else address this issue. This is a Swami named, American Swami in Boston named Chittananda. And it's the title is Useless Questions. To ask, what's wrong with me, is a useless question. If you ask this of yourself, you come up with a list of answers that extends from here all the way to the river. Maybe further. It's simply not a helpful question to ask in the first place. Instead, ask, what's right with me? If you can begin to discover what's right with you, this is so extraordinary and compelling that all the rest flushes away immediately. You may be conditioned to ask, what's wrong with me? But honestly speaking, when you take what's wrong with you and put it against what's right, you can give a simple answer. Nothing is wrong. Nothing at all. So we have to know what to ask. So what's right is a great question. What's really fundamentally right with us? And ask that over and over again. And be patient. Well, one of the ways to ask is to ask repeatedly. To keep the question alive. Don't expect an answer, but just hold the question, repeat it and repeat it. What's right with me? What's right with me? Who am I? Who am I? Or what's important? Just hold that and hold that for days, for weeks, for years, until it kind of gestates and something might arise out of there. Some possibility might arise out of holding that question without an answer that wouldn't arise at all if you just kind of not held it at all or come to some quick kind of off-the-cuff answer. It's important to ask questions which aren't too much, that lend themselves to abstractions. To ask questions like, oh, I don't know, what's a good example? What happens to me when I die? That, from a Buddhist point of view, involves us in the world of abstraction and is not conducive to deep answers arising within us, or deep questioning about what's this right here? Who are we? What's important? To ask ourselves, what has the most interest for us? Where is the enthusiasm in our life? To find what interests me in my life? What interests me about life? To ask that question brings energy. Because if you find what you're really interested in, you're most likely to act on it. And if you don't act on it, then you should ask yourself why. What's holding you back? What do I have energy for? Where is my energy? Many people talk about not having enough energy. But where is their energy? What does have energy? Sometimes what has energy is things that are unsavory, things that we don't like about ourselves. Sometimes people don't have any energy because they're so busy exhausting themselves, holding down their anger, squashing our life force by doing that. What has energy? Uh-oh, it's the anger. Uh-oh. Well, then maybe you've tapped into something great, at least energy, your aliveness. And then you can work with the anger and see if you can find maybe something more important, deeper, through the anger rather than repressing it. There's such questions as, how do I get what I want? And that's a little bit of a, suspect question. What do I want? But it can be turned around a little bit so that we can still ask, in a sense, what we want, but in a deeper place, a place from our wholeness rather than from our greed or our ambition or our sense of lack or inadequacy. We can ask, what is it? What actions, what ways of being in the world accords with our deepest sense of well-being, our deepest sense of truth or integrity or honesty, with our deepest values? What accords with that? To ask it that way, rather than, what do I want, is to ask, I think, can ask a question that brings, again, vitality to us in a healthy way. Because I think ambition and greed will only exhaust us. And the last thing way of asking, or what to ask, it belongs to what's called inquiry. An inquiry kind of is a wide word, but the way that's used sometimes in spiritual traditions, Buddhism and other Indian traditions, as I understand it, inquiry is looking very deeply at particular powerful formulations of basic questions. So, for example, most powerful one that often is done is the inquiry in who am I? And you ask, who am I? Or you hear the freeway, the sound of the traffic, and you ask, who hears the sounds? That's a very important one in Zen Buddhism. Who hears the sounds of the world? The first koan that many Zen students are given to work on when they do koan practice, the first spiritual kind of question that they're asked to grapple with in their spiritual life, is the question, who hears the sounds of the world? And if you go to the teacher and say, well, I do, he kind of hits you over the head. And if you go and you say, I don't know, he hits you over the head. At least the teacher I studied with was very gentle. It was kind of like a nice tap. But there's an answer. Who is it that hears the sounds of the world? So who is it that hears? Who is it that questions? Who is it that's aware? What is awareness? What's aware of awareness? To ask such questions until you get the questions exhaust themselves. There's an ancient tradition of doing that. So to live in this world with curiosity, with interest, with questioning. So the spiritual quest. The spiritual quest, I believe, involves having questions. So the question is, what are your questions? Have you ever thought about your deep, what are your deep questions? What is most important for you? Ask that question of yourself. What is most important? Jack Kornfield talks about asking yourself the question, have I lived well? Have I loved well? What have I loved in this life? To ask these questions and see what comes up. To ask not with some flip answer or not kind of reactively say, oh my God, not that question, or you know, or nothing, you know, I haven't lived well at all, you know, forget it. But just to ask, hold open the possibility and see what arises in this wonderful world that we live in, the world of possibilities. Hanshan, that great and crazy, wonder-filled Chinese poet of 1,000 years ago, said, we're just like bugs in a bowl, all day going around, never leaving their bowl. I say, that's right, every day climbing up the steep side, sliding down, over and over again, around and around, up and back down. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry, moan, feel sorry for yourself. Or, look around, see your fellow bugs. Walk around, say, hey, how are you doing? Say, nice bowl. Any questions? Yes.
It's kind of an interesting question about questioning is that sometimes when we ask a question, we never really question the framework of the question.
Beautiful.
And sometimes the answer lays in questioning the rest. The thing that we're not questioning that sort of brings. It's like a deep puzzle, and we very complicated puzzle. We sort of piece everything together, and we're left with four or five pieces. And we kind of question those four or five pieces we have in our hands, but we're not questioning the things laid down already.
Yeah, beautiful. It's a very important point. And maybe you can give an example. I'll give an example first, and then you can give an example. The question of the meaning of life. I've said this often enough, I think, here. But many people, you know, their quest is to find the meaning of life. And that seems like a worthwhile thing to do. But what we do in Buddhism is we allow for that. But in Buddhism, we look at what's behind that, what's under that, what's motivating that, and we ask, where does the need for meaning come from? And that is an interesting question. So now, can you give an example?
I'm a software engineer, so software can sort of model things in very, very different ways. This is very helpful for creativity. And sometimes together in a team, we come up with a bunch of questions that we cannot resolve. And the people that are the most helpful in that questioning are the people who question the framework that everybody has built, rather than the pieces that we can put together. And sometimes by questioning a framework, we sort of come up with a whole different framework where the question doesn't exist.
Uh-huh. Well, I think mindfulness works that way very powerfully, mindfulness practice. And the classic place is has to do with self-identity. We have some idea that I am this, I am some identity, I'm in some fixed way. And mindfulness practice, one of the functions of mindfulness practice is to pull the rug from underneath the belief system that feeds into the way in which we create a fixed identity for ourselves. So we question the underlying assumptions there about identity. In Zen, they had this ritual, questioning ritual. It's called Dharma Combat. And the Zen abbot sits in his chair, and there's kind of an aisle in front. Everybody's kind of sitting on either side, and there's this open aisle. And the students take turns kind of walking up that open aisle and standing about 2 feet away, or get down on their knees, and they ask this question. And part of the way it's talked about, at least this San Francisco Zen Center, is that you're supposed to take the you're supposed to think for a long time about the questions you have about your life, the questions you have about your problems or whatever, and think about it until you can refine it to the kernel of the question, the kernel of the issue, and then you throw it out. In Zen, you're supposed to be kind of vigorous about it, you know. You throw out this question, and the abbot's supposed to throw back his answer. That's supposed to be enlightening and wonderful and whatever you think. And it's quite intimidating because, you know, you're sitting there, you know, in a Zen growl, you know, and it's daring you to walk up with your question. Yeah. Should we do that here? Some night?
Is that your question?
Yes.
It's, in the Hasidim movement, which is an Orthodox movement in Judaism, and there's a lot of parallels between that movement and Zen. There's a story where the student's really frustrated and wants to know the meaning of life and goes storming into the rabbi and asks him, you know, I'm frustrated, I'm looking for the meaning of life, you know, I don't know what it is. And the rabbi goes, I don't either, but let's have dinner.
It's very similar to the Zen story of the Zen student who comes to the abbot. Says, I want to come and I want to study here and learn the secrets of enlightenment and truth of existence and all. And the abbot says, well, you can come and do that. And so he says, what should I do now? And so the student says, what should I do? And the abbot says, have you had your breakfast? And the monk says, well, yes. And he says, well, then go wash your bowls. So, and then in Zen, I'm supposed to go home now and wash my mouth out. Oh, yes, Adam.
Let's see, actually, this talk is perfect. I was going to ask you about questions, but I guess in meditation, I mean, I really, there's a phrase from Rilke that I really like, live the question. And the question, I think you've pretty much answered it. How do you ask the question kind of mindfully, bodyfully? You know, if you were going to sit with a question, do you think about the question and then sit and just think about it, or is it, how do you pose it and then wait for an answer?
Live your question. It's a great expression. I have, just in my own life, there's different ways in which I hold questions, depending on the question, the issue, or whatever. Sometimes I might go for a walk and just kind of, it's more mental, kind of ruminate on something, and just kind of come back to it over and over again. But sometimes it's possible in meditation. Sometimes what I do is, I'll sit for maybe half an hour, and just sit to be as focused and settled as I can, not thinking about anything in particular. Just trying to get really settled. And at some point when I feel myself, you know, at a certain level of settledness, then I'll pop the question. I'll ask the question. And I might kind of repeat it kind of periodically, kind of in a kind of gentle kind of rhythm. I might ask the question periodically, you know, and just, or allow it to sit there. Or sometimes there's a way in which you can kind of allow it to sit in your stomach. You know, just kind of sit, let it sit and hang there, this question, the sense of the question. And just do that, and occasionally something out of the blue will kind of rise out of that, and sometimes nothing will rise out of it. Sometimes I found that it isn't when I'm asking the question the answer comes. That sometimes, but the intensity of the questioning allows for the possibility of some other answer to arise. But it's often not when I'm asking the question. So it's often when I stop asking the question, when I release myself from the question. So. You know, to go and just kind of be completely kind of consumed with a question sometimes, and then to go meditate, or then to go do something else. Sometimes I find in my own life that the most important answers in my life, in a sense, have come from that kind of questioning. Questioned very deeply what I should do. And I went around for a number of days, many days, kind of questioning, wondering, trying out all the possibilities in my head, but not really expecting the answer, just kind of. And then either sitting in meditation or doing something like meditation, and then like suddenly my body shifted. Something changed within my body. It was like my body answered. And then I knew. It wasn't like my mind answered. It was really, it was a felt sense, my shift in my body. And I knew absolutely. There was no doubts at all. Know what to do. So, last
question. Form, but it's not even a jewel. And with that answer to the question, Nagarjuna had a kind of awakening experience and gave up this a method of questioning to practice Buddhist style meditation.
So it's not what it appears to be. So what is it? Thank you.